I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thank you for joining us today for The American Idea. I am Kara Rogers-Stevens, Associate Professor of History at Ashland University and one of your hosts for The American Idea podcast. One of my greatest pleasures in my work for the Ashbrook Center here at Ashland is every now and then I get to participate in seminars on important historical issues for high school teachers across the country. And in these seminars, we sit around at a big square table and we discuss great American political debates, issues, topics, using primary documents. Through these experiences, I've gained so much respect for the many incredible educators we have across the country who are dedicated not only to improving themselves, but also working to improve the lives of their students. So today I have great pleasure, and it's my honor, to welcome to the show Jeremy S. Adams, a man who taught at the same public high school in Bakersfield, California, for more than 20 years, and who has also dedicated himself not only to self-improvement, but to improving the lives of his many students at the high school and also at a college in the area. And because teaching isn't hard enough by itself, he added the title of author to his resume, writing op-eds and publishing 5 books now. He's a graduate of Washington and Lee University, and he has received numerous accolades over the years for his teaching, including California Teacher of the Year from the Daughters of the American Revolution. In 2012, he was the Kern County Teacher of the Year, just to name a couple. He's here today to discuss his latest book. It's called Lessons in Liberty, 30 Rules for Living from 10 Extraordinary Americans. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So we're really pleased to have you here. Now, before we get into talking about your latest book, I would love to know, what made you choose writing in addition to this already thriving career that you had of teaching?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, what's typical in the trajectory in the career of a teacher is usually about 10 to 15 years into your career, you kind of want to change it up a little bit. Maybe you want to go be an administrator, or maybe you want to go work for the union, or maybe you want to change schools. Because I, for some reason, really like low self-esteem, I decided to try and be a teacher, an author who's also a teacher. Anybody who's ever tried to be a successful writer will tell you that it is an up at dawn, pride-swallowing siege that is difficult to describe to people who don't have that, you know, ambition that is just full of rejection and failure. You know, as you probably know, you get rejected so much, you probably feel like you're in high school again. But that being said, I'll give you the honest answer, and that is I am an absolute unapologetic romantic about the written word, about books, about ideas, and especially books and ideas about the American experiment and this incredible civilization that we have. And so I have been inspired so many times by so many books, by so many authors, that I think that one of the most kind of glittering ambitions that you can have as a human is to try and lend your voice to the chorus of your country, to try and say something inspiring or something useful. And I think as a teacher, after I'd done it for 10 or 15 years, you know, I never want to leave the classroom. I'm going to be doing this until I'm gray. But sometimes you want a little bit of a larger audience to kind of teach the things that you think are important. And so I love writing. I love words. I love books. I love having conversations like the one we're about to have. And so that's really what drove that ambition. No matter how hard it was to find some success, it's absolutely been worth it.
Well, that leads straight into the next question I was wanting to ask you, which is, how does your work in the classroom inform your writing and vice versa?
Yeah, there's no question. I want to be clear. I am a teacher who writes. I'm not a writer who happens to teach. And, you know, one of the things that completely changed my life is I realized that, you know, if you're a teacher, especially a, you know, public high school teacher, you're never going to be famous. You're never going to be rich. Your name is never going to be in lights. But we do have one superpower, and that is that we see things before everybody else in civil society does. And so about 4 years ago, kind of my first big book was called Hollowed Out. And it was about the fact that I was seeing all these things. You know, I stand at this privileged intersection of parenting and technology and culture and politics. And I was seeing all these things that were different. You know, it's not like I've been teaching for 5 minutes. I've been teaching for 21, 22 years. And then the last 10 years, I'm like, hold on, something's wrong here. Our students don't read. They're not happy. They don't know anything about the country. They're not patriotic anymore. They don't want to date. They don't want to have families. They don't want to get their license. They don't want to go to the movies. All these things that were kind of this sudden shift in the worldview and the behavior of young people. And so I felt like saying, look, I'm seeing things here that maybe you don't see yet, but it's going to be a profound and colossal problem going forward. And so that's why when I wrote about those things, I found aha. That's the secret sauce. That's what people want to know about. And so it's kind of, you know, Carr, it's kind of annoying where, you know, you'll see an article in a very prestigious, you know, like The Atlantic or The New Yorker or The Wall Street Journal, where they'll talk about how, hey, kids are addicted to their phones. Really? We knew that in the classroom 5 years ago. We knew about anxiety 5 years ago. We knew about, you know, the fact that they have a very negative view of America. We knew that 10 years ago. So that's kind of why I write, is because I'm trying to tell the country, look what's coming our way. We need to be aware of it. And this book that I just published was what we're going to do about it, hopefully.
Wow. Yeah, I can so identify with the things that you're describing, seeing in your students. I know those show up in my freshman classrooms as well. And every year, my colleagues and I kind of commiserate with one another and say, are we all seeing the same thing? Do we think that there's a commonality? Is this just a phase that students are going through? And we've become more and more concerned over the last few years by the different struggles that students just seem to be dealing with so much compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago.
And that is so well said, because, you know, you're like, is it just me? And then you talk to your colleagues at your school and you're like, well, is it just my school? And then, well, is it just my city? And then you start to do, you know, if you write the way I do, then you start to do research and realize, hold on, this isn't localized. This is a problem. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, we're not just talking about little things here and there. We're talking about the things that connect human beings to values and institutions and behaviors that lead to human fulfillment and to flourishing and to happiness and to all the beautiful things that life can be. And then our young people simply aren't doing it. You know, it's actually quite simple. I don't think human beings have changed all that much. The same things that fulfilled the human soul 2,000 years ago fulfill us today. And if you take away friendship, and you take away family, and you take away learning, and you take away religion, and you take away all these things that we know lead to human flourishing, it shouldn't surprise us that we're teaching the most unhappy, depressed, anxiety-ridden generation in American history. And that's, you know, that's kind of where I do feel very vindicated, Carr, if I'm being honest, because when I first started writing about these things 3 or 4 years ago, people would yell at me, oh, you're okay, boomer, you're a crank, you're a curmudgeon, you know, every old generation thinks the next one's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yep, yep.
And what I wanted to say was actually, no, this is unique because they are uniquely unhappy. And also, I'm way too young to be called a curmudgeon. I'm only in my 40s. So you got to be, you got to have a pipe and be in your 60s to be called a curmudgeon, I think.
Well, that's good to know. I'll remember that. Yeah. So there are other books out there that address the mental health crisis or the addiction to cell phones. There's some good works that are starting to emerge, offering some potential and solutions to the crises that we're seeing young people today face. But tell us about Lessons in Liberty, your latest book. What is the goal with this book in terms of addressing this crisis that you're describing with young people?
Yeah, not to, you know, engage in hyperbole, but this was literally the book I've wanted to write my whole life.
Oh, wow.
And I feel like this is the right time and the right situation to write this book. So, you know, all these things I wrote about my last book called Hollowed Out, all the loneliness and the despair and the anti-Americanism and the isolation, all of that. You know, it was a book about what's wrong. But really, this book is a book about, well, what do we do about it? And, you know, I am, as a teacher, this is my 27th year in the classroom. And if I had to distill everything I know about teaching into one immutable truth, it is that we learn by example. And we are either improved or depraved by the exemplars in our lives. And, you know, when you read, you know, the greatest generation in human history, which I think is the American founding, you know, you look at, well, what made them what they were? How were they able to create the first liberal democratic republic in human history. How are they able to create this? You know, you look in the back of the $1 bill and it says, Novius Ordo Seclorum, a new order of the ages. How were they able to do that? And very quickly, you know, you start to read about Plutarch and about their love of history and about the need for models and exemplars. And what our young people lack today is a lot of examples and inspiration in their lives. A lot of them come from broken homes. We know that they don't read the way that they used to. We know they don't go to church the way that they used to. They just simply don't have adults and learning the way that you and I did when we were growing up. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to say, well, who are some of the most inspiring, fascinating, incredible Americans in all of our history? And I wanted to kind of write this for, you know, I wrote this for everybody. This book is for, it doesn't matter if you're 15 or 95, but I'll be honest, I really would like, you know, high school and college students to be reading this, because what are they trying to figure out? They're trying to figure out how to live their lives. They're trying to figure out how to use this God-given liberty that they have to live a meaningful and full life. And they need role models. They need practical advice. They need to know that there are people who come before you who are just as broken, just as screwed up, just as likely to deal with despair or, you know, broken relationships and whatever, but yet they were able to use their freedom in a meaningful and purposeful way. And I wanted to, as a high school teacher, I wanted to inspire them. So this book is very accessible, I hope, very inspirational, but also very actionable. I mean, it's very practical. Here are people who have found a way to live meaningful lives, and here's how you can too, just like our founding fathers. You know, there's a reason why John Adams loved Cicero. There's a reason why Hamilton supposedly loved Julius Caesar. Yeah, there's a reason why they signed Federalist Paper with Publius, right? There's a reason for this. They found exemplars in history, and we can do the same.
So what you're saying is TikTok is not the place to go in order to find inspiration to live a better life, that one needs better examples, perhaps from further in the past, than the sources that many young people seem to be going to right now.
Yes. I mean, so well said, exclamation point, you know, as to what you just said, because, you know, for so many young people who watch TikTok all day or Snapchat or Instagram Reels, that medium is filled with cynicism, you know? And so if you ask, what do I see in young people? I see so much cynicism. I see so much negativity. And when you have this kind of negative view of America and its and the country, you know, you're not going to go back into its past to be inspired, because you think that anything that happened before 2015 is tainted. And yet I would tell you, I mean, and I think anybody who reads the first page of Lessons of Liberty would know that I believe that our history is like buried treasure. And, you know, refusing to dig it up, even though it's gold, is just folly. It's just silly. It's a tragedy. And I think really, you know, I think we, at this point in American history, we need to ask, what does it mean to be an American? What does being a citizen in a republic require of us? Because, you know, one of the consistent themes of the book is that the American way of life is not natural. It's special. It's unique. It requires constant care, constant recreation. The idea of making a more perfect union is the charge of every generation, but it doesn't happen on accident. And so, I mean, I don't know what you thought of the book, but I think you can probably tell I'm an institutions guy. I'm a culture guy. You know, I believe that, you know, I'm not trying to raise a generation of activists. I'm trying to engage and inform and educate Americans so they understand what the American idea is and how to renew it and what to do with it and how to live up to it.
So tell me, one of the things that I like to do with my students when I get them in the classroom is we start with American History 212, discussing the founding, and I'll introduce them to the concept of voting for the greatest president. Who are the top three presidents in American history? Yeah. And this last year, I was particularly surprised by the level of cynicism that students seem to bring to the table. And I tried to make a case for George Washington as consistently he ranks number one when Americans are polled about their favorite presidents. My students weren't very impressed, didn't immediately. He did not come to mind for them. They couldn't really think about anything all that special about what he did. It took me quite a while to try to build the case for why is George Washington worthy of our time, our attention? How is he not just a foreign, distant, bewigged, dead white guy. So yeah. I know he's the first chapter in your book. Can you make a case for George Washington? Say one of our listeners is feeling a bit cynical about the founders and their many flaws. Why should we bother reading George Washington or caring anything about his life? What can he still teach us today?
If I had to distill it down to one, where there would not be an America today without this one person. Again, we all know America would look different without Jefferson. You know, you wouldn't have the beautiful lyrical declaration. You wouldn't have the Constitution the way it is without Madison. You wouldn't have had the financial plan without Hamilton. That's great. I love it. But you wouldn't have had an America. We probably would not have won the Revolutionary War, not because Washington was a great general, but because he commanded a certain Cato-esque virtue, you know, the Greek word for that is arete, right? This virtue that what this guy is doing, he's not doing it for himself. He's doing it for a broader ideal. And that's why even people, you know, like John Marshall would be more than happy to fight and die with him. And so you don't win the Revolutionary War without a George Washington. You don't have a constitutional convention without George Washington. You know, if you look at the correspondence between Madison and Washington in those years after the failures of the Articles of Confederation, you know, Madison, I think, is our greatest strategic thinker in American history. And he knew that without the moral and political gravitas of Washington, you don't have a constitutional convention. But the birthday of the United States of America, I always say it's not July 4th, it's September 17th. The Constitution is what created one nation, right? We constituted it. You know, the Constitution is not just a noun, it's a verb. We constituted a new nation, and yet it needed a kind of moral leader. It needed somebody with the kind of universal respect. And I think one of the reasons why your students and my students have so much trouble understanding the moral and political power and gravitas of Washington is because there is nobody in American history today that comes in the universe of the kind of acclaim and respect that he had. You know, one of my favorite story about Washington that I hope your listeners will go back and read up on is when King George III heard that Washington was going to retire his commission, he just didn't believe it, because that's not what great men in history did. And he said, I don't believe it, but if he does it, then he is the greatest man in all the world. And Washington got power by giving up power, right? He won the Revolutionary War and he goes back to Mount Vernon. He's president for two terms and he goes back again. He doesn't want to be president. He doesn't want to go to Philadelphia in 1787, but he does these things, and that's why people trust him. I mean, juxtapose this, Cara, with today's politicians who will say and do anything for power. You know, and as you well know, Jefferson said, be very careful of people who want power. Those are the very people in the Republic we shouldn't trust. And that's why, you know, all the founding fathers, they had to hide their ambition, right? They always had to say, I don't really want to do this. We all know Washington, you know, he cared about his reputation. We all know Jefferson wanted to be president. Madison wanted to be president, but they were careful not to say they wanted to. It's so interesting in how you juxtapose that to power today.
It's also fascinating that politicians in those days weren't rewarded financially the same way that modern politicians are. I genuinely believe that there are times in George Washington's life that he wanted to just go home to Mount Vernon. He wanted to be left in peace. This is, I think, one of the things that the Hamilton musical gets right very beautifully. And I cry every time I hear that song where George Washington and Hamilton are working together on the farewell address. And Washington is so pleased that he has been part of creating this peaceful nation where every man can sit under their own vine and fig tree and no one can make them afraid. And you can just hear his longing to go home to Mount Vernon and sit underneath his own vine and his own fig tree and finally be able to rest after this life of genuine self-sacrifice on behalf of his nation. That's perhaps very difficult for our modern students to understand, a politician actually suffering in service of their nation.
Yeah, and I that's such a brilliant point, so beautifully said. I think people forget sometimes, you know, he died during Adams's term. I mean, he really did give it all. I do believe, I think the song in Hamilton is One Last Time.
Yeah.
And as a Jefferson scholar, I wonder how you, I don't know how much love you can have for that place. He really does get beat up pretty bad in the play. But, you know, to me, I do love Hamilton. And I do love the fact that it has brought a lot of kids to American history in a way that nothing else has. again, here we are 9 years on from that play, and none of my students listen to it anymore. Nobody knows much about it. Shelf life for about 3 or 4 years. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if you got to the end of the book, but I think Teddy Roosevelt would be a great musical. Talk about a towering, fascinating, fun, inspiring life that you could sing and rap and dance about. I would love to have a play called Teddy. the whole thing would be wonderful. I don't know if you agree or not.
Oh, I'm all for as many presidential musicals as we can get. It's a great way to learn about history. And it's a real shame that students are not as familiar with the Hamilton musical. Although you're absolutely correct, there are parts of it that are seriously flawed when it comes to Thomas Jefferson. But, you know, any scholar of Hamilton is going to have trouble liking Thomas Jefferson, and vice versa. We just pick up the likes and dislikes of the people that we study, unless we're very careful not to. So I'll give him some grace for that. And I enjoy the musical nonetheless.
Me too.
Yeah. But going back to your book, so you've told us your best case for George Washington. And I think that was very well said. You're even sort of making me at least intrigued about Theodore Roosevelt. I want to hear more about why you would think that he's somebody who's worth our attention as much as George Washington. But they're not the only two people that you write about. No. So you're talking about 10 individuals in this book, one chapter per individual. How did you come to choose the historical figures? And are they all presidents?
No, not at all. And in fact, I mean, you know, the way that, like I said, as I said earlier in the podcast here, my book is supposed to be very inspiring and actionable, right? So each chapter is distilled down into three life lessons from each of them. And I wanted the book to be, you know, readable, fun, inspiring, accessible, but it is, there's a lot of self-help in here. I think that, you know, Washington, not to overdo it on Washington. Washington was the first self-help president, right? I mean, he constantly was trying to get better. People forget he had this awful temper that he had to master. Mm-hmm. We all know that he hired Hamilton as his aide-de-camp to clean up his letters. And so I picked 10 Americans, first of all, who I just think had a lot to offer, you know, what were incredible, inspiring life lessons. But I also wanted to make sure that this was not a book that was grounded in one time period. I have Americans who are founding fathers. I have Americans like Ben Knight, Horace Campbell, who are still alive today. I have people who would be considered liberals, people who are considered conservative. I didn't want it to be a conservative or a liberal book. I didn't want it to be a 19th century or 20th century book. So I wanted to have the whole landscape of America, because I believe this beautiful, boisterous, pluralistic society of ours has something to teach all of us. And I really wanted to give voice to all of them. And that's why, you know, there were a lot of people I wanted to write chapters about. I would have loved to have written a chapter about Abigail Adams. I would have loved to have written you think about incredible Americans who are so important but never became president. I mean, I would tell you the three greatest Americans who never became president were John Marshall, Martin Luther King, Alexander Hamilton, and yet none of them were written about in my book, right? And so, you know, I have, when I did the research for the book, I mean, I've been teaching for so many years, I know a lot about a lot of these people. So obviously I knew a lot about Jefferson and Washington and Madison and Teddy Roosevelt and Lincoln. But frankly, the process of writing it, I enjoyed doing the research on some of these incredible men and women I didn't know a ton about, like Ben Knight Horace Campbell, like Clara Barton, like Daniel Inouye, the long-term senator from Hawaii. There are so many incredible, inspiring people in American history that if you just read deep, and you're the academic between us, so I think you know that sometimes when you get really, really deep into the biography of these people, two things happen. One, sometimes you discover things that you kind of bristle at. You're like, ooh, yeah, you really are a flawed human being. You really are. I understand why people don't like everything about you. Mm-hmm. But then you discover things that you discover that you respect even more. You're like, oh, wow, that's something that we should really bring up. So, you know, the greatest compliment I've gotten from the book is people who will say, you know what, I thought I knew a ton about Washington or Jefferson or Madison, but I didn't quite know that. And so tried to bring out these threads that were really inspiring and interesting. And I also tried to introduce some people to the landscape of America that maybe, you know, a 20-year-old going to Ashland University doesn't know about. Yeah. And those were really rewarding chapters to write. Yeah.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. Conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
Yeah. I mean, just to give people a taste for this, the title of chapter 5 is Arthur Ashe, Don't Let Other People Pick Your Fights. Yeah. Or chapter 8, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Prioritize Relationships. Maybe not the first thing that people think about when they think of our Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but you were able to go in and find these unique elements of their humanity, these individuals' humanity, and focus our attention on those things.
And I love that Ruth Bader Ginsburg chapter so much because, you know, so many of the lessons that I highlight in the book are really, I think, solutions to what ails the souls of our children today. I mean, two of the life lessons of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, one of them was the fact that she talked about, you know, we have this era where so many young people don't want to get married. So many young people are lonely. You have this kind of this stratified where women in their 20s are becoming much more liberal and young men are becoming much more conservative at a time when politics is becoming the anchor of their identity instead of, you know, clan or family or community or God. It's politics now. And I love this the section of the book where we talk about her romance with her husband and how, you know, essentially, you know, he went to Harvard and they'd just gotten married and he got testicular cancer. And what did she do? She attended his classes. She helped write his papers. She helped take notes as they had a baby at the same time. And I just love. And she talks about how, you know, you have the most revered liberal icon in this part of American history, saying the best part of life is family. It's not going on the Tonight Show. It's not being, you know, part of a, you know, RBG, the documentary. It's the fact that my husband loves me and my children love me. And that's more powerful than anything else. The other part of the chapter is the ability to have friends with people who think differently than us. You know, her best buddy on the court was Antonin Scalia. You know, the greatest conservative jurist of the last 50 years, the father of originalism. And yet there's no question his best friend on the court was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And they really understood that their friendship was bigger than politics. And they could love America, but understand that their love of the country was bigger than their disagreements. And I say this at a time when so many people are losing friends over politics, family over politics. Now I'm telling you, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia can have an incredible friendship that's not ruined by politics, so can we. And that's the kind of thing I write about in the book.
Now tell us, as you were choosing these 10 different individuals, and they really are from all these different time periods, different walks of life, different ethnicities, male, female, wealthy, not wealthy, what makes all of these individuals Americans? In what way do they exemplify something that is uniquely American?
Such a good question. And I'll tell you what unifies all of them, because you're right, I did want to have a very diverse and kind of tapestry of the country. The thing that unites all of them is that they were Americans who learned how to deal with the central paradox of having freedom, right? And so on one hand, in order to have a meaningful life, you have to be free. But the problem is, if you don't tether that freedom to wisdom or purpose or something bigger than yourself and your own self-aggrandizement, then that freedom just becomes narcissism, right? Liberty becomes licentiousness. And these people realized how to use the gift of freedom to live a good life. And that's what I worry about with so many Americans today, is they're free, but they're unhappy. They have liberty, but they have anxiety, and they don't know how to use their freedom well. And this is the thing, is that young people do not come equipped with the knowledge of how to use their freedom well. And the biggest mistake I see in the classroom, and I don't know if you see this with your college students, is students confuse the freedom to with the freedom from, right? So a lot of young people say, well, I don't have to believe in this. I don't have to go to church. I don't have to get married. I don't have to do that. And so as a result, a lot of people in their 20s are untethered to anything meaningful. They don't have to throw down an anchor into anything. And so they're kind of adrift on this uncharted personal sea. And it's making them absolutely miserable. Being a father to three children is hard. Being married, I've been married for 25 years, is hard. Teaching at an urban high school for 27 years is hard. Trying to be a good Christian is hard. But let me tell you something. The ties that bind us are also the ties that define us. And I want young people to know that they have the freedom to decide what to tie themselves to. I mean, that is so magical. They can go to any church. They can live anywhere. They can believe anything. They can say anything. They can love whoever they want. That is not normal in human history. That we are living in the outpost of civilization. We are living in this little perch of time where I would argue that our young people are the luckiest human beings to have ever lived. We are freer. We are healthier, we are wealthier than any human beings ever. And it didn't happen on accident. It was created by the kind of men and women who I talk about in the book. And our responsibility is to make sure that the next generation of Americans can enjoy the fruits of freedom that we have. But we have to learn how to do it and do it well. And that's really what the book's all about.
My next question is almost silly by comparison. And that was, I'm just curious if there was anything that was very surprising to you that you learned through your research for this book. Any particular facts or pieces of information about these individuals that you had absolutely no idea about until you got to the research portion?
Yeah, I mean, literally with all 10 of them, I could go all 10, you know, and talk about why I didn't know this and I didn't know that. I'm a humongous tennis nerd. Arthur Ashe is one of these people who I think is not revered enough, not loved enough, not respected enough. And here's a guy who, you know, felt like he was late to the game of civil rights in the 1960s and committed himself to dealing with South African apartheid. I think, you know, very well about South Africa and about all of those. And he's the one who made Americans aware of what was going on there. But I remember as a tennis nerd, you know, he won Wimbledon in 1975 and he had to play his nemesis, Jimmy Connors, never beat Jimmy Connors except for one time. And the way that he prepared for it was he went to a Playboy club the night before in London and had this, this session of talking to other players about how am I going to beat this guy? And that's how he prepared for it. And I love that story. That's just a human thing that you would never expect. I do love that when he talked about that morning that he walked out in the center court to play that Wimbledon final, he said, I felt like the kind of the wings of destiny were on my shoulders. I knew I was going to win this. It was the only time he ever won. You know, he went to the South African Open a number of times and really wanted to win the South African Open. And both times, he got to the finals and Jimmy Connors beat him. But I do believe, you know, like Lincoln felt, you know, Lincoln talks about how, you know, at the age of 26, Lincoln was, we wouldn't use the word depressed back then. We talked about melancholy. He was so depressed that they had to take away all of his knives and everything was sharp. And his best friend said, you know, you have to rally Lincoln or you're going to die. And Lincoln said, that would be fine, except for the fact that nobody would know that I had ever lived. Having that sense, our lives means something, that we are meant for something bigger than our own enjoyment. That's consistent with all 10 Americans. And I wish every American felt that way.
Well, what else would you like to tell us about the book that we haven't been able to talk about so far? I mean, this sounds like an incredible collection of facts, of stories, of inspirations, of lessons that people can glean from these different individuals throughout history. What else do you want readers to know about this?
You know, I think the most important thing that I really would want readers to know is that it's not like a novel. You don't have to read, you know, the first page to the last. You really can, you know, read the chapters that you know, the people or the lessons that you think are the most interesting and relevant to your life. I really did write this book because, you know, I believe that we have this incredible story that can do so much to help us live better lives. And so I guess there's kind of two lines of ambition here that I want people to know about. The first one is individually, that we can study these lessons and their lessons and their lives can kind of seep into our souls and help us live better lives today. I mean, I think anybody who's ever fallen in love with learning and books has this moment where you're like, oh my goodness, people who were dead 100 years ago or 2,000 years ago, somehow what they're saying is still relevant to me today. And that spirit, I want individual citizens to pick up on that and feel the power, the kind of the patriotic palpitation of that. And the other thing, though, there's a civic mindedness here. I want people to realize that it means something to be a good American, that being a good American requires much more than just voting every 4 years. And I think that we have developed so many horrendous civic habits in the last decade or more that I think are destructive to the American experiment itself. And again, I'm not a fatalist. I do believe America's better days can be in front of her. But I am worried. I think that we're producing a generation of Americans who don't know about the ideas, the animating ideas of the country, don't understand what the ideals are, don't know about our founding documents. I mean, goodness gracious, Cara, you have one out of three Americans who believe that, you have one out of 10 Americans who believe Judge Judy sits on the Supreme Court. Only one out of three Americans can name the three branches. And so, you know, there's two lines of ambition in the book, kind of the individual life, but also the civic life. And I just would beg everybody, do not take this country for granted. It is more fragile. The fragility of freedom is more potent than you can imagine. And I think this book helps to remind us of that.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. We are more free, more wealthy. We have more options in front of us right now than we ever had at any point in human history. And the irony is that this is the moment at which we're seeing so much depression and cynicism and hopelessness. I completely agree that it is so important for young people to look back in order to appreciate what we have now. And
it's a maddening
sense of purpose.
It's a maddening duality, isn't it? You know, at the height of our civilization's success, you have so many people who think so little of it and so little of themselves.
And
it's very, very sad. And you know, again, I'm not a man of many talents, but I love my country and I feel like I can write and I can talk. And so I'm just trying to use the meager talents that I have to try and, you know, help this civilization just a little bit, because I'm definitely never going to run for office. So this is my...
I don't think that would be as much fun as being a writer and as a teacher, quite frankly. Now, I cannot let you go without asking about Chapter 4, Thomas Jefferson. Now, I know that you're not his number one fan. Probably neither am I, but both of us find in him somebody fascinating, somebody worthy of study. You chose to title your chapter about Thomas Jefferson, "Don't Specialize, Be a Generalist." Not the thing that people are probably going to immediately think about when they consider Thomas Jefferson and his modern reputation. Why is he worthy of being part of this fascinating combination of history and self-help that you have here in your text? Why include Jefferson? What is it about him that we should learn from?
I think Jefferson understood better than anybody else in American history one of the great keys to happiness in life, which is that it is necessary to have as many joys as possible. You know, we live in this era where we have so many kind of commercial values. You know, we tell everybody, oh, go major in engineering, go be a specialist, know one thing really, really well and focus on that. And you got to get your side hustle and just make sure you focus on this thing and that thing. And Jefferson, I think Jefferson lived this beautiful life and filled it with so many different joys. And by the way, I do love Jefferson. I'm an unapologetic lover of Jefferson. I mean, I frankly think that I fell in love with this country. I had a professor in college at Washington and Lee who was writing a book, and I spent an entire summer going through the collected works of Jefferson. And it has hurt me very much the last 10 years, the discourse in this country of the way that we look at the father of American freedom, the father of American democracy. It has hurt me, but Jefferson understood that a great life is it's all of the above. It's a lot of reading, and it's being a musician, and it's playing the violin, and it's traveling, and it's wine, and it's friendship, and it's politics, and it's ambition, and it's everything. That life is so big. It's so full of possibilities. And, you know, that's why I say at the end of that chapter, or the introduction of that chapter, what would it look like to follow Jefferson today? And it would require that we come to terms with the immensity of our potentiality, that Jefferson understood that there's so much that we can achieve and know and enjoy as human beings. And yet, what do we do for 9 hours a day? We scroll on our I won't even use profanity, but we just spend so much time scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. It is a soul-crushing reality that you could go for a jog, you could go for a walk, you could learn how to do Taekwondo or play pickleball or read a poem of Keats. And what are we doing? We're doing the same thing every day. And Jefferson understood that a big life, a happy life, is full of all of these glittering possibilities. And he to me, I think he is the most incredible American that ever lived. So I hope the book didn't come across that I was not a Jeffersonian man. I am. Flawed. Of course he's flawed. And he's full of questions. But you know who else is? You.
Everybody.
And everybody, right? Yeah. So yeah, I love my, I hope you like my Jefferson chapter. You know, because I really do believe that kind of making up with your friends, I do believe that taking religion seriously, and he did.
I'm so glad that you emphasized that. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure what he, you know, what his kind of religious beliefs were in the very end, because he was so private about it. He would have hated the fact that there's such a thing as the Jefferson Bible. He's like, that was supposed to be a private thing that he did on his own.
Absolutely.
But so many young people today have such a negative view of religion. All they think about is that it's just judgmental, which is it's so basic and it's so disappointing. A lot of my students, I was talking about Teddy Roosevelt and the bully pulpit, and they didn't even know what the word pulpit was. They didn't know that the first book of the Bible is Genesis. They're just very religiously ignorant. And again, I'm a public school teacher. It's none of my business what your religious faith is, but you should at least know what the major religions of the world say about the possibilities of the human condition before you condemn.
I think that's a major strength of your book, that there are so many areas of American history that have become so politicized, so many political figures and leaders that are claimed by one partisan group or another, or criticized for political reasons. And some of them need to come underneath specialized scrutiny. And it's been a good thing for over the last 20 years to have some extra attention put on different areas of that are deeply flawed and tragic in America's past. But what you've done here, I think, is going beyond the aspects of individuals' lives that pertain to political debates today to look, again, at their humanity, at the areas of their lives that that made them human, that made them grow, that made them so relatable to individuals today, that now, looking at Thomas Jefferson, aside from all of the controversy surrounding him, and just thinking about if he had had a cell phone, how different would the world be? How much less would we have? And I think in some circles, he's known as the father of modern archaeology, and he contributed greatly to scientific knowledge. He was an inventor and a tinkerer with other people's inventions, who created all of these things. He brought macaroni to the White House, for Pete's sake.
He was so quirky too. I mean, he had this, he had such a kind of spirit of the people, the demos, that he loved it when foreign diplomats would come in with their European regalia, and he would have a shirt that has a skin on it, and he would have this bird on his shoulder named Dick, and he would be feeding the bird as he was doing diplomacy. I mean, it was so quirky, and there's just a million things about Jefferson, and I think he might even be disappointed to know that we pretty much just talk about his politics, so many things that he contributed. I started the chapter talking about his gravestone. Three great freedoms, political freedom, religious freedom, and intellectual freedom. Yeah. I would just love to get Jefferson on the couch and say, what do you think of quantum mechanics? What do you think of the entire 19th century and Darwinism and Marxism and Freud? And I mean, there's so many things, and he would have loved all of it. And he wouldn't have picked a side like that, because he understood nuance and complexity in a way that we just don't today.
Wow. Yeah, if I could have a time machine.
Yes,
that would be the one conversation. There's so many things that I'd like to ask him. And as you point out, some of these people are very difficult to truly get into their psyche and understand them well. But what we can glean from them is incredibly valuable. And I think that your book has done a fantastic job of taking these 10 lives and making them relatable, making them instructive, making them interesting and fun to learn about and to discuss. And I can tell that you must be an incredible teacher because your passion for your subject comes through in every conversation. So thank you again so much for writing this book and for coming on the American Idea podcast to talk about it with us. I encourage all of our listeners to check this out. I'm assuming this is available on Amazon.
Everywhere, yeah.
And everywhere else. And again, the title is Lessons in Liberty, 30 Rules for Living from 10 Extraordinary Americans. Jeremy, thank you again.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.